Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today, hopefully for a two-episode arc, is someone who anyone who does appellate law in Texas is going to know. And I'm going to introduce him by stealing and paraphrasing something he said about his own mentor. This is the person who has taught me everything I know about appellate law, but not everything he knows, my friend and partner, David Keltner. David, thank you so much for being here.
Jody, thank you for asking me. And Todd, appreciate it.
Sure. You got to hold something back. You can't show all the cards right away, can you?
That's exactly right. Well, and I've worked with David, I guess, going on 16 or 17 years now. I don't even know.
17 years.
It's been a long time, and there's still plenty for me to learn because you're constantly teaching me stuff. But I think probably a lot of our listeners know exactly who you are. But still, if you'd spend a little bit of time and just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of maybe some of your background, we'd love to hear about that.
Well, let's start with legal background. That's the most important thing. I got out of law school in 1975, which seems that was in the last century. And it was sort of an interesting time. Got out of law school in the middle of a big recession, which sort of reminds us of today. People were wondering whether the economy would recover nicely. It did not, and ended up in the 1980s crashing with the real estate issues and went down pretty hard, especially in Texas. Graduated in 75, worked briefly in London, and took a job with Shannon Gracie, Ratliff & Miller in Fort Worth, a firm that no longer exists, but a remarkable place. Did a lot of insurance defense work. That's where I sort of, I guess, cut my teeth on litigation. And that's initially what I did. Was able to try a lot of lawsuits. That was a golden time for a trial lawyer because you could get to trial. We handled workers' comp, small things like that. But they got you in front of juries where you got to face a jury looking back at you and facing you down. And that was a great experience for me. So I got to try a bunch of lawsuits. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say how many. But I always wanted to do appellate work. But for the longest period of time, I dealt with jury trials. The interesting thing was I had not had in law school a course that dealt with jury submission. So I had the court's charge was something that was completely unfamiliar to me, and I had to learn that. And with the help of Kleber Miller and some others, with practical help and then suggestions of what I could read, it was Gus Hodges' book, I eventually learned that process and learned that you could actually have a great impact on what a jury might decide if you could ask the questions right and get the right instructions. And that made a difference to me as well, got me closer to appellate work, which I wanted to do.
So how did you get into appellate work?
Well, it was a sort of upsetting experience for me. I wanted to do appellate work, and I was trying a lot of lawsuits. And Kleber Miller, my mentor, as you mentioned, looked at me, and he said, I've looked around the state, and the appellate lawyers I know have no personality and are just dull as they can be. You have at least some personality. You can't be an appellate lawyer. And then he pointed out that was funny, and this was over a drink, and he then said, seriously, it's an unholy marriage to do both trial work and appellate work at the same time because the deadlines don't mesh. On that, he was absolutely right. But what happened and where I was very lucky is we had a man in the firm now deceased named Gene Dozier. Gene had clerked with the Texas Supreme Court and for the most part did any appeals or assisted trial lawyers who did appeals. And he was a go-to guy. He left about 3 years into my stay at Shannon Gracie. So I secretly went behind Kleber's back to all the lawyers in the firm, especially when I knew they'd had a rough experience or a very good experience, and lobbied to get the appellate work. And it was almost like I hung out a shingle, said David Keltner, appellate lawyer. And before anybody knew I wasn't, I was. And that's how I actually got involved. what happened during that period of time, it was another golden time. And you're going to hear me later tell you that I think currently is the best time I've ever seen for appellate lawyers. But during that time, we had a change in the Supreme Court. Part of it was Democrat to Republican, but it was a more basic change than that. There was, for the longest period of time in the 70s through the mid 80s, a time period in which the standards of review for legal sufficiency were loosely interpreted and probably bastardized. In fact, it took City of Keller to get that straightened out. But nonetheless, a period of time, if it went to a jury, your chances of reversing it were slim, and you had to have absolutely no evidence whatsoever. So it was one of those things, times were changing, the courts were getting more actively involved in the quality of evidence as well, and rules of procedure became important, like far different than today. The plaintiff side of the bar was much more effective in using appellate waiver than we see now defense lawyers use it. It's equally wrong both times, but nonetheless, that was the case. And I'm going to mention a couple of my friends in that, Rusty McMaines, who I refer to as the late, great Rusty McMaines. He really was. Understood the charge almost better than anybody in Texas, including judges, and understood how it was possible to waive error and had a hawkeye look at that. And a lot of cases were decided on waived objections. I mean, Island Recreational, classic example of that, that went on. We went from a broad form submission issue that really got started during that time period with a universal acceptance of that view. So during that period of time, it was great to get into appellate work, and appeals started having much more impact than they had before. So I was very lucky to hit that period of time in the late 70s. Things sort of heated up, and they continued to do so all the way through the 80s. And there were some really significant changes during that period of time that made a difference.
Well, and the Texas Supreme Court in particular changed a lot during that
time. Absolutely, they did. And the interesting thing was, it was a change in different viewpoints. While the Texas Supreme Court had been primarily totally Democratic before that period of time, virtually every judge in Texas was a Democrat at that point. There was a conservative element, and we could go through the judges individually, that were on the court and basically conservative about creating new causes of action, very conservative about error preservation and the like. In the early 70s, going into the early 80s, some new people got elected through statewide politics that were more liberal. And we got a number of people on the bench, some former state senator, several former state representatives went on the court. In fact, two state senators, and they had been more on the liberal side of the party. And that started a period of time in which plaintiffs were very successful in the Supreme Court. Successful in two ways, though, Jody. I mean, they were successful, I believe correctly so, for basically if a judge had granted a J&OV, getting that reversed. Or if someone had not been given a jury trial, getting that reversed. Or zero verdicts, sometimes getting those reversed, those on appeal, which was prior to that heard of. We also had a fairly conservative legislature during that period of time. And the Supreme Court in three separate occasions created new law because the pointing out that the state legislature had not been able to pass a products liability bill, a wrongful death act that set what the actual damages were. Mm-hmm. There was one other I can't call right now, but there were three during that period of time. And the court was not hesitant to step in and say, we need to get this rectified. And some of it, candidly, you could very much understand. I mean, for the longest period of time, a parent could not recover for the loss of an adult child. Children had difficulties in recovering sometimes, other than the Wrongful Death Act, which is constitutionally based, had difficult times recovering for the loss of the parent. Bystander recovery were unknown at that time. That's the third one. And we created a bystander recovery standard that is still today. So the law was changing fairly rapidly, and not necessarily by the legislature itself, but often by courts that were subsequently dialed in by the legislature. I mean, I'll give you one classic example. There was about the advent in DWI cases of the mothers against drunk drivers. There was, I think, a social movement designed to make drunk drivers responsible for the damage they caused, and also, more importantly, to prevent drunk driving. And the court came up with a number of causes of action that one could bring against social host or against a drinking establishment. That lobby in the legislature was so huge that they were able to reverse those, which eventually turned into Supreme Court decisions interpreting those that limit the amount of liability those people could have. But those kinds of things were going on in the 70s and 80s that were dynamically changing law.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
And then later in the 80s, at a fairly young age, you decided you wanted to be on the Court of Appeals.
Well, by that time, I had started doing appellate work. And while I was still trying lawsuits occasionally, I was doing much more appellate work than I had been doing. And I was beginning to attract some appellate work outside of the firm. So instead of just doing Shannon Gracie's appeals, which were significant, I was doing appeals for other people, sometimes friends, more often from outside of Tarrant County, where we were basically trying to guess what the Supreme Court was going to do. So I think everybody spends the time thinking they need to be a judge. And I certainly was thinking that way. And I had been encouraged by people to run for a trial bench or be appointed. And I had sort of resisted that. But luckily for me, Walter Jordan, who had been on the four Court of Appeals for a long period of time and had been a very long-term district judge. I mean, I think he had over 40 years of judicial service by the time he retired, called me to let me know that he was going to resign his position early because of health issues. And when he announced his resignation, it was inside the time, it was right before an election. And the primaries were coming up, but they had a very brief open the filing deadlines. It had passed, opened that again, and seven of us were got to end that deal. Fortunately for me, all but one of them dropped out. And the guy that stayed in was a guy named Fred Fick, great guy. And Fred was the chief briefing attorney at the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, who had been encouraged by the chief justice to throw his name in. He eventually, by the way, dropped out about a month before the actual election. It was then in May in the primary. I was in a deep spot. His name was not off the ballot. His name was still on the ballot in mine. If I lost to Fred Fick, I was going to have to leave the state. So in any event, luckily enough, I won. And I think my immaturity showed in my opinions. I think got on the bench. I did not have, that was a Democratic primary. I did not have a Republican opponent. So the governor was Mark White, called and said that he would appoint me early if I wanted, but I was trying to finish up. And so I convinced him to let me joined the court in September, and Judge Jordan agreed that he would stay on until that time. So that all worked out for me, and it was a good thing. I very much enjoyed my time on the court, but they still celebrate my resignation day as a court holiday. They were glad to see me gone.
I'll tell you, your stories about serving on the court make it sound like a very fun workplace.
Oh, it was. It was. I was very lucky. We had a fascinating group of judges from very diverse backgrounds. This is going to sound strange to our viewers today, but this was only 4 years after the Court of Appeals got criminal jurisdiction. We used to have a bifurcated system that was not only the Court of Criminal Appeals and the Texas Supreme Court. The appeals from the district court in criminal cases went directly to the Court of Criminal Appeals. So when we got that jurisdiction, the number of people on the bench expanded. So that was new to me. We had several people who had done nothing but criminal work. We had two primarily domestic relations lawyers who were elected directly to the court, did not sit on a trial bench beforehand. Everybody else but me was a former trial judge, which I think is very helpful. I think that's, if I could pick the ideal judge, I would want them to have either extensive litigation experience. I'm not sure how extensive litigation experience you can have these days without being a trial judge. They made a big difference, but it was a disparate group, and we had a lot of fun. what I think Jody's responding to, they did a, for the appellate section, did a piece with all former judges, and they got me. And unfortunately, you had done David Ferris before and had learned all of our pranks while we were up at the court. It's a monastic. One thing I don't think lawyers really understand, being on the court is a monastic existence. It truly is. You are isolated. I had grown up on crime lawsuits. My friends were trial lawyers. The people I socialized with were lawyers, mainly trial lawyers. All of a sudden, I couldn't talk to them. I certainly couldn't talk to them about their cases or the case they just tried because it might be coming to our court. And that was an isolating. So we came up with a number of diversions to try to ameliorate that factor. And sometimes we did and sometimes we didn't. But it was a good experience. I think that mostly what I learned there was what judges really need to hear to make a decision. I thought I knew, and I was wrong. It really requires something much, much different than what I expected, but it was a very good time. The bad thing about it, and Jody's heard me say this before, what I really disliked about it was the political aspect to it. It wasn't so much the politics. I can understand the difference in those types of things and points of view. In fact, during the time I was on the court, the Republican Party became much more powerful, basically swept out all the judges' positions in Dallas and eventually in Houston. And Fort Worth was a little slower to change, but what they did there was recruit the sitting judges who basically, with the exception of one, transferred over en masse to the Republican Party. And there was going to be a change. I felt that the Democratic Party got me there. I wasn't feel comfortable changing parties, although there's no such thing as Democratic justice or Republican justice. But what that meant was the cost of an election went up dramatically. I mean, it's hard to believe how our Chief Justice had been Howard Fender, who had been a very active Democrat. In fact, had been the district attorney of Tarrant County for a period of time and had been a district judge, was defeated by a Republican. And I think everybody thought that was going to be very difficult. It turned out not to be difficult at all. Todd was great. Everybody got along with him. We made sure that he felt welcome. I think he really appreciated that. But on the same token, did his job very well. And we all were very supportive of each other. And it made a dramatic difference. But then everybody, is there any time there's a change of political parties in the judiciary, it gets new people an idea they can run. Mm-hmm. We've seen that in Houston and in Dallas recently. Some people had experience, some didn't have any at all, but every race was going to be contested. And you were going to have to raise large sums of money to be able to get the word out. And what does a judge campaign on? I can be fair. Well, I can be more fair. It's those kinds of things. During that period of time, the Code of Judicial Conduct prohibited taking positions on any matter that might come before the court. Now, that's since changed. But it was an absolute at that point. And even as today was one of those issues, and you get calls from groups who would call and say, listen, we want to support you. How do you feel about abortion? And you'd say, well, I don't think it's likely it'll come before court, but if it does, I can't comment on it. It was very upsetting to me. You get the comeback. Well, we just talked to him, and he said he's against abortion, would never vote for it. And so, my goodness, what do you do? And then they say, we'd like to be for you, but if you can't tell us how you'll vote, we won't be. During the same period of time, there was the first shot at the medical malpractice reform, and doctors, groups would call you, want to know whether you could support the constitutionality of caps on actual damages or punitive damages. And that was something I felt like I couldn't commit to one way or the other. And that was problematic. And I had represented a large number of doctors during my time in private practice. And I think they felt disappointed I wouldn't take that view. But I felt the code prohibited it. So I was uncomfortable in that regard. Raising the money, unfortunately, I do not feel uncomfortable raising money for other people. But raising money for myself was painful. I mean, literally, I would stay up at night knowing I was going to make a call the next day to ask for money from a particular person. And I felt badly about it. I had lists made up of people who had appeared in front of our court, so I wouldn't call them. And I learned to my chagrin that some of the other members of the court in other courts were using that same list to call those people. So it was difficult for me, but having my hand out for money was very difficult. Jody, I was approached then by, we had a resignation on the Supreme Court, and it was filled by the appointment of Gene Cook from Houston by the Republican governor, I think it was, by Republican governor, Bill Clements. And what happened later, there was, within a matter of months, there was another open. And the Democratic Executive Committee of Texas, it was, again, outside the period of time of the primary. So the Executive Committee picked, and they offered me the position of running for the Supreme Court, which is, man, all I ever wanted. But the night after we'd had an informal meeting with the Executive Committee, I stayed up and Larissa and I talked about it, and I knew that the rest of my life would be raising money. And I went in the next morning and asked to be relieved of that, and was, and I've not regretted that decision at all. I would have run against Charlie Ben Howell, the guy that in Dallas came courting his pajamas, and the Democrat run that race, that was Bob Gammage, another member of the legislature that got on the Supreme Court. I think I was saved because eventually, as a Democrat, I've been wiped out in any event. But my service on the Court of Appeals was a lot of fun.
One thing I wanted to tease out, if I could, David, you mentioned, before we shift gears too much, is you mentioned that you learned what justices needed to have to make decisions. And it was something that you didn't necessarily know as an advocate before you went on the bench. Will you spell that out for us so that we know?
I'll tell you what I think it is. And I think all judges are a little bit different. And it depends somewhat on their judicial philosophy. Anytime we talk about these kinds of things, I have talked about the one judge that I think was probably one of the best judges of all time, Tom Reeve. And Reeve, just Judge Reeve to me, always had a view of the rule of law. And people mean different things by that. It's something we say as a catchphrase. But what it means is the law is carefully developed and you have to apply the rules in a way that it is carefully developed. It's not what you think it is. It's not what you wish. It's what precedent requires you to do and what higher courts' views are. And you have to understand your role in the system. So I'm big adherent of that. And I get upset with judges who I think step outside that. But Todd, to your point, here's what I learned. Certainly, the facts of any case dictate how the opinion is going to come out and what the ruling is going to be. But the real truth of the matter is the ruling has to fit within the fabric of the law. You can't consider the case in abstract. You have to consider how it fits with other cases and whether your ruling here impacts another area of the law you didn't intend for it to impact. And advocates that do not explain how a ruling would fit into the law and do no harm to existing law are making a big mistake. And to the extent that I've been lucky enough to have appellate courts adopt part of our briefing, it has been because we try to do that. We'll say this, your ruling here would fit clearly within the Texas Supreme Court holdings in A, B, C, and D. I think that's very important to do. The other thing is that I didn't know is extraneous matters aren't important to courts. They don't really care in a personal injury case if the plaintiff is 5 payments behind in child support. They're not supposed to care, and they don't. It's not to say we can't add spice to the argument about things that happen, but in making a decision, those kinds of things aren't important to a judge who's doing good work. So the other thing I learned is storytelling is just as it was important to the trial court, it's very important to a court of appeals, if done honestly and forthrightly. The last thing I learned actually from Cleaver Miller, the best trial lawyers by far, are the trial lawyers that reduce everything to its lowest common denominator. And they have a theme of their case, and everything is simple. Same thing is true in appellate courts. And in fact, the theme of cases has to be based on one matter. So I think that's important. That's what I learned. Some people would argue, Todd, I didn't learn it very well. But nonetheless, that's what I came away with.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedeas bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, Contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
Well, we appreciate you sharing those nuggets. I wasn't going to let you get away, and I'm sure Jody wouldn't either, but I definitely wanted to hear that perspective.
So I do want to back up a little bit because I think your story dovetails with something, which is kind of the development of appellate practice as a specialty in Texas. And that's not something traditionally that existed and maybe existed a little bit before you, but not a whole lot before you. Can you kind of trace us how that became a specialization and a practice in Texas?
Unfortunately, I was part of it, but that shows my age. Remember, we went into certification in the late 70s, early 80s. The first time the state bar convinced the Texas Board of Legal Specialization to authorize specialties. We did it, candidly, to mimic the medical profession in the very specialties they had. So we came up with the testing procedures, experience requirements, and the like. And that board was a fascinating board. And we started off, I think it was personal injury trial law, civil trial law. There were some real estate issues, I think, that came in during that period of time. And of course, now it's gone, but there weren't any appellate issues. And in fact, after I've been on the court for a year, the Board of Legal Specialization authorized a specialty in civil appellate law. We couldn't, and the reason it was civil appellate law was we couldn't get criminal appellate lawyers to join us because at that time they believed that if you weren't board certified, that they would not get appointed appeals and thought that could be a big problem for them. That's turned out not to be the case, but nonetheless, that was a legitimate fear. So we went our own on civil appellate. And in fact, in the first board exam, I had already been board certified in one of the trial certifications. So I had passed the procedural part and I drafted that for the first appellate certification courses. And Mike Hatchell, Rusty McMains, I want to think who else. I want to say Skip Watson, but I could be wrong about Skip, drafted the substantive section of the appellate law exam. And I took it and Larissa kept on wondering, and every other judge on my court said, why are you taking it? If you fail it, you're going to look like an idiot. And by the way, a Texas Supreme Court judge who took the exam did not pass it the first time, but did the second. So long story short, that's how we got started there. But if you look at the appellate firms, practices, boutiques, all of that, mid-1970s. Look back before we look forward. First off, there weren't very many appellate lawyers that purely did that. There was Jim Cronzer in Houston. Jim had come up with a wonderful firm, the Abraham Watkins firm, in which he had been a named partner. John Hill, the subsequent attorney general, had been a member of that firm and one of the red-hot trial lawyers of his time period. And he and Cronzer together not only won things, they held everything they won because Cronzer was that good. And he was. He truly was. But Cronzer had separated himself from firms and was by himself. He was hired by people on both the plaintiff's and defendant's side to help their appellate lawyers with things. And he was extremely gifted, a great guy and a wonderful man to know. He was in Houston. The major Houston firms had people who did appellate work, but they really weren't developed into sections. There were people that were associated with different lawyers like Marie Yates with Harry Reasoner and Paul Stalling. I could do others. Tom Phillips with people in that firm. Fulbright, you had people like Bill Boyce and Reagan Simpson who were dealing with people that were actively trying lawsuits. In Dallas, it was Royal Brent, and Royal had, if something happened on the insurance defense matter, Royal was going to get that appeal. And it was, had people work with him at Strasburger doing those types of things. There was Mike Hatchell. Mike was actually in Tyler at the time, and Mike had clerked in the Supreme Court. And then we had Wayne Scott in San Antonio, who had interestingly clerked on both the Court of Criminal Appeals and on the Texas Supreme Court. I think that's right. They would be hired by people to do things. Periodically, Lewis Muldrow was hired as an appellate counsel, but Muldrow was teaching at Baylor at that time, but he had been at Naaman Howell and a world-class trial lawyer, but there weren't large groups of appellate lawyers. And most lawyers did their own appeals, sometimes to good effect, other times not. I look back, I started thinking about examples of that. Coke Stevenson, who had been governor of Texas, he's the one that Lyndon Johnson beat with the Duval County vote count with Lyndon Johnson. But Coke Stevenson was a masterful lawyer. And he, while he resided in Junction, he tried cases all over the state. And he was an active practitioner. I looked yesterday and I found over 40 appeals that he had around the states at the Texas Supreme Court of Criminal Appeals. So he did criminal work as well, and courts of appeals all around the state. He was known as a trial lawyer, but he did his own appellate work. But in another case that you saw me work on, I ran into a Mr. Jackson, who obviously had been a red hot appellate lawyer in doing, trial lawyer in doing oil and gas stuff. But he wrote a number of law review articles and he cited cases that were important to a recent appeal. Todd, I looked him up and he did the appeals as well. And that's the Jackson Walker.
Oh, okay.
By the way. So it really was an interesting time period where people were, if you took the case in, you tried it, and you probably appealed it yourself. Mike, I think, and things started changing a little bit. Rusty McMaines had been with Fulbright. Did a lot of appellate work there, helped out in cutting charges with people. Rusty was larger than life. He broke off on his own and started doing appellate work primarily for plaintiffs in the end, though not so much. Did a lot of commercial appeals as well. He started sort of to industrialize the process by talking to people about how to do it, setting interesting fee structures, and we can get into that, but they were fascinating. He and Mike Hatchell started working together on a number of things and were very close friends. They were kind enough to include me before I went on the bench in a number of appeals. Pennzoil versus Texas had a huge cadre of lawyers working for it. Bill Dorsanio was involved in that as well. Bill Boyce, Roger intricately involved in that. And those major appeals from bigger cases, the bigger verdicts got, the more important appellate lawyers became. So we all of a sudden, where we had been the nerds of the profession, we were the ones that were really at the wall. And that changed things. In the mid-80s, you saw Rusty McMaines moving to Corpus, starting his own firm, doing all the South Texas plaintiffs work, but also looking at other kinds of commercial defenses. He and I worked together right when I got off the court in 1990 in a significant appeal, but we had specialists that were out there were marketing themselves as only doing that. Kronzer continued to do extremely well, started working almost totally in commercial cases, not doing much injury work at all. Royal Grin got Mike Young and a whole bunch of other people, and they were billing that section. I was lucky enough to go to Haynes and Boone, a great firm that had one of the best lawyers of all time, I think, Nino Cortell. And we were able to put together an appellate section there that was sizable. And the way we looked at it is, if something bad happens, we can be on the ground within 5 or 6 hours, try to figure out what happened and try to come up with a strategy of undoing it. So what we did is do what corporate sections had done. We changed the dynamic a little bit to put a lot of people on it to discover what had happened, where the pitfalls were, and how we could make it better. And if you remember back in those times, we had the DTPA, the insurance code that had weird, that combined together, that created multiples of damages, and with punitive damages on top of that, those types of things call for somebody that could get something undone very quickly if somebody got hit. And those were, on both sides, were fascinating things to work on. And the larger firms decided that were still involved in dispute resolution, decided it was important to have sections to do those kinds of things. And they started proliferating. And all over, Mike Hatchell eventually moves to Austin. He was with Locke Lord for a period of time, now with Haynes Boone, with groups of people. Skip Watson moved in from Amarillo, been with an Amarillo and Lubbock firm, and is now with the Greenberg, I think. And we saw a number of significant changes. Then we saw in the 90s, going into the 2000s, the start of appellate boutiques. Doug Alexander, classic example of that, with a group of people that has changed over a period of time, as all of our groups have, but going out and saying, Roger Townsend was part of the formation of that group. He left Fulbright, where he'd been in charge of that section, and basically said, we do only appellate work, trial lawyers hire us. And they've been very successful doing that. There are others as well that have done that have those group, and I'm trying to think, who am I thinking about?
Yetter Coleman.
Well, I'm going to talk about Yetter Coleman in a minute, but I was thinking about Randy Rhodes started a group in Houston, basing themselves as a boutique and handling trial strategies and things like that. And very quickly, I think the traditional bigger firms decided to do the same thing. And all of a sudden, their trial sections were developed with multiple lawyers, very much mimicking the firms that did United States Supreme Court practice around D.C., Williams and Connolly, for the longest period of time, Kirkland and Ellis had a very healthy United States Supreme Court team, as did Aiken Gump. For the longest period of time, just the United States Supreme Court advocates. When some of us decided that was a good model, but it was a good model in Texas, it ended up working. And some were inside larger firms, some were out. The great thing about that is lawsuits got more focused. If you really think about it, one thing about a trial lawyer, is they've got a whole bunch of things to work on, and they're focused on winning the case. What appellate lawyers are focused on is burden of persuasion. We're going to help you win, but we're also going to keep it when we do. If we lose it, we have a way that we can eventually reverse it. And that became a major field. And again, with bigger judgments and bigger verdicts came more necessity for appellate lawyers. The interesting thing is, I think, Jody, what has now happened is we see appellate lawyers involved in all stages of the practice, basically saying, you deal with the burden of persuasion and the burden of proof, we'll deal with the structure of how you submit this case. So that really made a difference. I think the other thing that started the appellate specialization was jury charge. In the 70s and 80s, starting with Island Recreational and cases that had hinted at broad form previously, the Supreme Court, at one point, we had an advanced appellate course in Austin, the state bar course, and we had a Supreme Court panel. And then Chief Justice pondered that there were probably less than a dozen lawyers in Texas who understood how to preserve error in a jury charge and how to submit a jury charge. Now, horrible thing about that, Todd, you were laughing, but the horrible thing about that was that the issue was everybody got together. Of course, McMaines knew he was one of the 12, and Hatchell was pretty sure he was one. I hoped I was considered as one, but wasn't sure. And there were a number of other people who fell in that category. We'd sit around after the course and have drinks. We'd think who's in and then who wasn't a member of it. And that was a larger group. But the fascinating thing about that is our special issue submission over the years has gotten terribly complicated. We tried to change it. We have, at the Supreme Court Advisory Committee, have gone a number of times to simplify the process for preserving errors. Trial judges don't want that because they feel they can get ambushed. The issue with that to me is it's not their trial. Nothing's unfair to a trial judge. A trial judge is there in the rule of law sense to do a specific job. But in any event, we've not been able to get that done. It's still a difficult issue that you can really mess up if you're not careful. And
yeah, we're going to talk about that in more detail in a little bit for our next.
Maybe that's another issue. But in any event, that very much helped the appellate practice because people who got very serious about it, we've seen another with successive generations of people coming in, increasingly members of appellate section and pure appellate lawyers have never tried a case, might have been in a courtroom some when a case was tried, but have never tried a case. Increasingly, also, our judiciary, appellate judiciary for sure, don't come from the ranks of trial judges. I'm going to use two examples of the opposite of that. I mean, one of Nathan Heck's great gifts is he was a trial judge for a number of years, tried a number of very significant cases in the time he was on the trial bench before he went on the Court of Appeals, and then ended up on the Texas Supreme Court. Jane Bland, same thing. That gives you a pragmatist view of what really happens in trial court so that the decisions are based on real life experiences. Increasingly, we're seeing people go on the court that don't have that experience, certainly on the Supreme Court of Appeals, maybe even more so. And in the trial court, that's a first level, but you hope that people have tried cases. But the last three judgeships I was consulted on by the person who was going to appoint them or his office, none of them had even tried a case. So there are less trials to try now, but we've got some interesting issues going on. So the group of people doing appellate work has changed from old has-been broken down trial lawyers like me to more people doing different kinds of things. And remember, Hatchell and McMaines didn't try cases. They were extremely good but they sent through, I can't wonder how many cases Mike Hatchell sent through. I think it would be in the hundreds. And Mike knew the ins and outs of what went on in a trial court as well, still does, as anybody, and Rusty McMaines too. So that's been an interesting, as we progress, that's how it has progressed. The question is where it goes next. I like to think about those things. And we will sustain ourselves, I mean, as long as two things are true. One, cases keep getting tried by other people. That's one. So we've got to have an active trial docket. Two, if the positive motion practice continues to be what it is currently. Remember, it's been in the last two decades that Texas has adopted anything that looks like the federal system's summary judgment 12, all those issues. And now we've got other rules than 166 that deal with those things. But that calls, begs for an appellate lawyer. I'd rather have an appellate lawyer doing dispositive motions than I would a trial lawyer. Trial lawyers, if they're truly good, are designed to go elsewhere. But as long as those two things continue, we'll have an active group. I just wonder how related to the actual trial of cases that group will be in the future. And I'm going to be sad if we still don't have a number of people who actively try cases in it.
Yeah.
We need more Coke Stevensons. So seriously, yeah. I think that'll make a difference. But
well, that is a great overview of sort of the evolution of Texas appellate practice. We've had some of the folks that were around in the beginning. We've talked to some of those folks before, and it's great to hear your perspective on that, David. I just can sit here all day and listen to you tell stories. Let me ask a quick follow-up, though. You mentioned, I think it was with Rusty McMaines and his fee structures. Can we drill down on that just a little bit?
I'll give you an example. We were involved in one case, and we both got calls on it. And Cronzer did, too. And Rusty called me real quick, and he said, I know he's going to talk to you. I know he's going to talk to you. Don't do anything until we talk. And it was a rather significant, at that time, very well-known verdict, hadn't gone to judgment yet. And Rusty proposed something like this, Todd, and it was fascinating. He said, look, and only Rusty could get away with this. I could never get away with something like this. He said, I'm going to charge you on a monthly basis. And it was something like $50,000 or $60,000 a month from now to the end of the case. If we win it, I want you to pay me an additional amount. And we were dealing with things which were, at that time, these were $200 million verdicts and things like that. And Rusty would say, and the reason I need this is, he said, I would bill you for my expenses, but the way I live, you don't want to pay for my expenses. I couldn't get away with that. I couldn't. My needs are more simple. But Rusty did it, had a jolly laugh. No one was offended. And Rusty had a number of wonderful cases like that in which he had monthly income that ran his farm very well. And there was genius to his ideas. I mean, one of the things is if you're unshackled from a fee, all of us that do work on an hourly basis know the pain of thinking, I've got to do this work, but geez, I don't think I can charge the client for it. But you do it anyway. And sometimes it works itself, part of that at least works itself into a fee. Sometimes it doesn't. But if you're working on a basis of either a guaranteed amount or flat rate, or under Rusty's deal with a contingent fee at the end, plus a monthly fee, you're not constrained by that. You'll go ahead and do that work that you feel that needs to be done. And I think it made great sense. I got into a number of other things. One of the, it's not an appellate firm, but Bartlett back out of Chicago, Fred Bartlett has similar fee deals of which where they get paid X amount per month, and they're much higher than Rusty's fees were, and then even more per month in trial work. And then what happens is if they win, they get a predetermined amount. But if they lose, they give back part what they've already been paid. We've done that a time or two. It has been successful. Jody and I worked on a case in which we took an artificially low rate because I think the other side believed that there would eventually be a settlement. And then we got a bonus on the end if we won. Those kinds of rates, I think, really do make a difference. We tried reverse contingent fees on the defense side. If we were able to reduce a plaintiff's recovery to a certain amount, the percentage basis on those don't work real well. I think it's better to do it categorically and just say, if I get it, if a judgment comes in A, B, C, and below this amount or this amount, then you'll pay us that. We've done a pure contingent fee in other matters. Thank God most of the time it's worked out, but a time or two it is not.
We've all been there.
We all have been there. Sometimes you do it involuntarily as well. It just forgot to pay you. But those types of things, I think, help build firms. We've now seen, we always have been, Todd, this is not directly an answer to your question, but it reminded me of one thing. For a very long period of time, we didn't have very many people coming out of the judiciary to go back into practice. Currently, the bar at the Texas Supreme Court includes two former chief justices. John Hill marketed himself as a former chief justice when he came off. In fact, one of my interesting times is I don't think the Supreme Court knew how active General Hill was going to be. And so they hung his, behind the Supreme Court justices, they hung the chief justice portraits. One of the, I argued against John, and rather Chief Hill or General Hill to me, not John. He'd always insist on everyone calling him John. But I argued against him in the Texas Supreme Court. And one of the judges said, well, you must have been able to tell what I was thinking, because the question I was going to ask you was X. And I got up and I said, of course he could tell what you're thinking. He's looking over your left shoulder. And the judge looked at me and they all turned around and saw the portrait and they went, oh, we shouldn't have that. It's been interesting, but we've seen a lot of judges come back into practice. John Casey is here, former Chief Justice of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. We have Boyce is with the Alexander DeBose firm. Tom Wright's firm has Eva Guzman and Wanda Fowler. We've seen a number of Kathy Stone. It practices in San Antonio and does quite well. Harriet O'Neill has her own firm that is doing appellate work and the likes. We have probably more appellate justices practicing appellate law than we've had in the past. Part of that has to do, I'm afraid, with judicial compensation. Our compensation system was much better in terms of the judicial pensions that were or judicial retirement available under the old Plan A. That made it not profitable, made it for judges to go on the bench and know that they would didn't have to build up a nest egg for retirement. That has not, in recent years, has not been as good. We are trying desperately to get that back where it should be so we can retain some of the justices that have left. I mean, Chief Justice Jefferson's been very forthright with the legislature about the reason he left was financial. He was a wonderful Chief Justice. Our current Chief Justice is as good as it gets, but having the Wallace Jeffersons in the system would make a huge amount of difference in the whole bit. We thank God we've been able to keep some of the people that have been on the bench for a long time, like Chief Justice Hecht, in office. And so that's been an interesting thing.
Well, I think we're at a great point to wrap up episode one, and we're going to come back with episode two, talking a little bit more substance about charge and oral arguments next week.
Oh, no.
Thank you, Dave.
Appreciate you being here.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.